I worked for Temple at that time, and I got a text, because, you know, we get the text message every time someone would get shot and are on their way to Temple Hospital. So I did get the text message, 6:20, and it came up, gunshot victim on Temple campus, Broad and Jefferson, and police are taking him to the hospital. I got that text message, but I didn't realize that that was my son until the doctor called, and which was like a minute or so later. And that was really just horrible. I don't wish that call on anyone.
They say your life can change in an instant. This is the story of that moment for our family. I'm Tashawn Strother, and this is Stronger Every Day, Healing After Gun Violence, produced by the Philadelphia Center for Gun Violence Reporting, Covenda Media, and me. My son, Walter Willis, was the one who was shot, but he gave me permission to share our story from my perspective. And even though you won't hear much from Walter, he sat in on most of the conversations recorded during the production of this podcast, which took place over Zoom because of the pandemic. Walter did record his reflections on his progress and goals, which you'll be hearing later on. On New Year's Eve of 2019, I dropped my son Walter off to get a haircut. Drove home and had only been home in my house for about 20 minutes when I got that text message. And then that phone call from one of the doctors at Temple.
The barber wasn't finished with the client that was before him. So he walked out and he was doing some shopping, and he was over by the Fresh Grocer on Temple campus. He was coming up the back, I guess, off of Jefferson and coming up the back way to go to the store. And three guys came out and pulled a gun on him. And I wouldn't expect that at 6 o'clock in the evening with so many people around that would have happened. And with all the cameras, the officer actually, you know, came with the car and put him in the car and took him up to Temple campus, because he felt that if he didn't get him there right away, he wasn't going to make it. And I'm so thankful for the detective. And they took him to the hospital. And I guess that's what saved his life. So as people say, you know, that the police aren't always good, there are some good police officers out there. It was one of my fears of him being out and being a victim of gunshot violence, whether that was as a result of maybe police contact or just simply, you know, going out, getting a haircut and being robbed and shot. So there's been quite a few documentaries on TV where people are talking about that. And it's so true because, you know, gunshot victim, person shot, they survived. But what is survival? Because, you know, my greatest fear was him being shot. But this has been a challenge way more than anything I could have ever expected. I'm so glad that he lived, but I'll say it's surviving, but it's not living, because he's not able to have that normal day-to-day. Thank you. I just remember that night, like when I got the phone call to come to the hospital. I can't remember his name. I have it written down somewhere. But he was like, are you Walter's mom? And he was like, you need to come right now. You need to come now. He's been shot and you need to come right now. That was like the scariest moment for me. I remember having to call my family and not wanting to. I have one younger sister, Natasha Lassiter. She and Walter have always been close. When I called Tasha, she and her husband were at a wedding. Her husband was actually in the wedding.
I wasn't checking my phone. You know, I was in church, and I just remember she called several times, and I eventually called back. But it was after the wedding, and I went across the hall.
And I'm like, Tasha, I hate to call you and tell you this, but, you know, the doctor just called. Walt's been shot.
You were really calm. You were like, I think you need to get to the hospital. Your nephew was shot, and you may want to get up here. And all I know is I just kind of dropped. I just remember dropping to the floor because it just shocked me, I guess.
And she screamed so loud that I can feel my blood from hearing that scream. Like, I still hear it in my mind.
This very nice lady, I don't know her name, I don't know anything. She just said, are you okay? And I was like, no. I said, well, I'm here for a wedding. My husband is Dwayne, and I think he's taking pictures. So she immediately took me into, I guess, an office, and she just started praying with me, and I was just crying uncontrollably. And I remember her just praying with me, and she asked me Walter's name. I told her, and she just prayed with me. And then I remember just telling my husband, I said, we have to go to Temple. Walter was shot.
You know, they came, and when they got to the hospital, my brother-in-law thought that Walt was dead because my sister couldn't get herself together. And I think she just cried all the way to the hospital. And it wasn't until he got there that he realized that Walt wasn't dead. And he was like, oh my God, Shawnee, I couldn't get anything out of your sister. I thought Walt was dead, you know. And just the trauma of even just having to say those words to your family. My mom, she was a nervous wreck. My dad was trying to get her together. And we all came down and, you know, we sat there. His friends were there. You know, everybody was there rooting for you all. You're loved. You know that, right?
It just felt very unreal, and I was just trying to process it. And I don't know if I was trying to get ahead of myself and brace myself for the worst case scenario. I don't know. But at the same time, I was trying to be hopeful. I just didn't know enough. And then, but I was feeding off of Shawnee because I felt like she was very calm. I saw her cry one time. And we were, I think we were all kind of at the, inside the cafeteria. And I think the doctors may have said that, you know, it just wasn't looking too good or something like that. And she broke down and she started crying. And she's like, I don't want him to die. And I remember her just crying really, really hard. And I, again, like I said, I was feeding off of her because I just saw her strength. Like, she was really strong during all this. And the other person that I was really feeding off was my dad. You know how, like, when your parents tell you, or you believe that everything's going to be okay, but they tell you it's going to be okay. And I believed it.
I just remember in the beginning days, you know, Walt, you can't give up. He was laying in the bed, and I'm sure he could hear me, but, you know, he was hooked up to all kinds of tubes and breathing tube, respirator, trach. He just had tubes everywhere. But I had this little red book, and it's a prayer book. And I would just, you know, read prayers from it to him every day. And just reminding him not to give up, because I was so scared that he wasn't going to fight like he needed to. And he really had to fight. It was a battle.
Walter's had so many challenges, so many infections. He had a dozen surgeries and other procedures at Temple University Hospital. It was just unbelievable, all the things that he went through. And Dr. Jessica Beard has been great. She's a great doctor, a great person. And Dr. Beard included me in every step of Walter's recovery.
The most profound thing about our initial experience together, Walter, I, and his family, is this incredible bond that sort of immediately I had with Tashawn, Walter's mom. And, you know, we were in it together from the very beginning. As soon as we got up to the ICU, she was there at the bedside. We were talking. I was explaining everything. And, you know, sometimes that resuscitation of the patient, that critical care of a patient who's so severely injured, is even more intense than the surgery. So it was just hours and hours of trying to get ahead of that bleeding and correct the what we call coagulopathy, or the thin blood. And Walter's mom was right there. We were really a team. And, you know, that's a lot of the time the way that I feel about my relationship with patients is that, you know, the patient and I are there together. And obviously I have a huge team too, you know, so I don't think Walter would have survived without kind of the expertise of all of our team members, but honestly also without this incredible support from his mother and from his family. His grandparents were there, and they were just so incredibly compassionate towards me too. You know, that was a huge part of it. So, and I think that one night was the very beginning of our relationship that's really sustained now over 2 years in an effort to heal Walter from this single gunshot wound. He came in to our hospital. He came into an area of the hospital that we resuscitate patients, called the trauma bay. It's sometimes an area where we need to do emergency surgery to save a patient's life. And Walter was shot in his left back over the area where his kidney was. And we were able to see that the bullet ended up in the right side of his belly, although we don't know exactly where when we do the x-rays. And he was very unstable when he came into the hospital with a low blood pressure, clearly that he was essentially bleeding out, or what we call in shock from bleeding. So we immediately took him to the operating room, started giving him blood transfusions, and attempted to get control over the many sources of bleeding that he had at his abdomen. And one of the things that we had to do was remove one of his kidneys that was essentially just bleeding profusely. One of the large blood vessels that supplies his intestines was bleeding. We had to ligate that. There were many holes in his intestines as well as an injury to his pancreas and his gallbladder and his liver. So, you know, this one bullet caused just a ton of destruction on its pathway. And this particular bullet too was a big one and a very destructive one. I've actually never seen a bullet completely transect or cut across a loop of intestine. And so in one of the paths of the bullet, his intestine was just completely separated from itself, not even a hole, but just blown apart. That was in an area of the intestine that is a very sensitive area where there's a lot of structures around it. So it was almost during that surgery, it was like at one moment we were winning and then another moment we were losing. Its blood pressure was low and we were giving blood transfusions. And we did, you know, what's called a damage control surgery. We're just trying to control the life-threatening things right now and do an abbreviated surgery with a plan to return to do more surgery. So we did that. And then we brought Walter up to the ICU. And I can still remember, you know, what room he was in. I remember the computer that I sat at looking at his labs, and we just ordering blood transfusion after blood transfusion, more than 40 units of blood just in the surgery. And then after that, many, many more units of blood. And when somebody has that amount of blood loss, their blood becomes very thin. So I gave him medications to try to thicken up his blood, different types of blood products, because there's no surgery that can help that when we get to that point. And that's really one of the areas that in my kind of specialty that is a big, big challenge. And that's what he was, you know, fighting with after the surgery.
When he was in the ICU and the doctors would come and they would do rounding, the whole team, they were just great, you know. They would explain things to me. We would have conversations about his health, and they would even let me have input into, you know, how he was treated. In a sense, you know, I kind of struggled with him being on so many different pain medicines and opioids and, you know, I know I probably got on their nerves, but I'm like, we got to get him off. We got to get him off. We got to give him the lowest dosage. We got to work through this.
Walter's never been one that talks a lot, but my sister Tasha could always get him to open up and talk. But he couldn't speak to her. Couldn't speak to any of us at all for 4 months. Between the trach and the breathing tube and the feeding tube and the ventilator and his vocal cords being so sensitive from all of that, he just wasn't able to. I would give him a pad, a clipboard, and give him a pen. And he would try to write some things down. Sometimes it was really hard to read what he put on there. And I don't know in the beginning if he was really coherent. And I don't know if all of like his motor skills and cognitive skills had returned fully at that point. But I remember asking him, you know, what's your name? Do you know your name? Can you write your name? And he wrote it and it was wobbly. I still have it somewhere. I kept it so I could show him, you know, you wrote your name. So that was, yeah, that was a good time. We kind of talked like that for a month or so. And I remember when they put a little piece on the trach that would allow him to have vocals. And the therapist would come in to try to teach him how to talk again. And the first time he heard his voice, it scared him. And he didn't talk anymore. He wouldn't do it. Sometimes, you know, with that piece on the trach, it can make you feel like you can't breathe. So I think that is what scared him more than anything. But I remember when they were telling him to sing, it was a nursery rhyme. I don't know if it was Old MacDonald or something like that. And he said, oh, when he heard it, and it scared him, and his eyes got really big and he stopped.
I was actually on the phone with him when he realized he could speak again. He couldn't speak. Like, so we would talk to him through the iPad, and I want to say it was Easter or something like that. They finally took the trach out or whatever it was, and I said, oh, I really can't wait for you to speak again. I was just talking to him. I think he might have just been nodding his head, or he spoke, and it both scared us. I was like, oh! And I cried so hard, like on the phone, like I couldn't believe that he spoke.
He called me. He called me one day and he just called and he was talking. And I was like, what? You're talking? And then the nurses and everyone started calling, he's talking. It's like, yeah, he just one day started talking.
Walter was in the hospital for 9 months, from New Year's Eve of 2019 until September of 2020. When he came home, we were so excited because he'd been away for so long, going to different facilities, and I just felt like coming home would help him to heal mentally.
I just think about when Walter had to go to a nursing home, and that was a horrible experience. He fell into deep depression. And he was a 31-year-old in a nursing home with elderly. When I say elderly, I'm talking late 70s, 80s. He's in the room with people like that. And I would know sometimes he would call and he'd say, "Mom, get me out of here. Get me out of here. I can't take it. And I'm listening to the person that's in the bed next to him, and they're moaning and they're groaning. And it was just a horrible experience. And, you know, he needed to come home. And Dr. Beard also advocated for him to come home instead of being in the nursing home because it wasn't helping. It was almost as if he deteriorated while he was in the nursing home. So yes, just having those resources, having people that can advocate for you, having the information you need to make decisions that will help you to move to the next level. Like when I made the decision for Walter to come home, I had no idea how I was going to make that work. But I knew that I didn't want him to not survive because we had come too far for him to sink back into that hole. And I don't know how I did it, but I went to the hospital. I was like, you know, you guys just show me what I need to do. Give me that patient education and I will do it.
I learned how to do so many things. Walter came home with open wounds in his chest, stomach, intestines, everything just exposed. And I was scared changing his wounds, giving him IV fluids and tube feedings. I felt like a nurse. It was so much work, trying to keep him from getting infections, but we made it until February.
One day we just woke up with a fever in it. It was 98 or something like that. And then I went to take the temperature again. And it was like 103 and he was burning up. So had to call the ambulance to come get him and take him to the hospital. And I didn't go to the hospital with him that time. I felt so bad, but I was tired, you know. So he went to the hospital. And I called Dr. Beard and she let them know he was coming. And, you know, so they were ready and prepared and everyone knew it because we were always there. So he went that last time and he stayed and he hated being in the hospital, which I understand because I don't even know how I would have made it being in a hospital for such a long period of time.
Walter has lost a lot of weight, and with the infections setting him back, Dr. Beard felt it was better for him to stay in the hospital until April when he was having his major surgery. He needed to be so much stronger to be able to survive the surgery.
That was a 9-hour surgery, and after the surgery, well, they stopped the surgery because he was so weak. You know, and she was afraid that if she continued that he wouldn't make it. And, you know, his lungs collapsed twice. and they didn't know what was going on, and he had to go back, have a couple of procedures in interventional radiology, and that was just scary.
We had a nurse come into the house a few times a week after Walter came home for the first time. But when Walter went back into the hospital and was there for so long, we almost had to start the process over again. So when he was home again after his surgery during that summer of 2021, I was taking care of Walter myself until we were able to get a new aide.
Every now and then I would let someone come over to help, but I was so scared for Walt. I really didn't want to compromise and have people around and him get COVID. You know what I mean? On top of everything else. So I kept the circle small. I was like the all over hospital worker. I was the nurse. I was the nutritionist. I was the CNA. I was the environmental services. I was just everything, because all of the things that they were doing in the hospital with all of these different people, I did that myself for Walter. And it was hard. Waking up in the middle of the night, he might be in pain or needed something, or, you know, just not even really sleeping that great because I'm worried, you know, about him. Walter didn't eat for a year and a half. So the first time Walter ate was he had the surgery in April, probably May. So he didn't eat from December 31st, 2019, until May of 2021. So he lost a lot of weight, 40, 50 pounds. But because his stomach, they had to almost do like a gastric bypass, I guess you would say. So his stomach is much smaller. And he's probably not going to gain so much weight. But until he gains some weight and gets the strength, Dr. Beer's not going to do it until she feels like he's strong enough, because it's going to take a toll on his body. And I think that's another thing that we've kind of dealt with. You know, he went into the hospital, he had the surgery, and then he had his recovery period. Then you have to have another surgery. And that sets you back again. So then you have to recover. So it's just like a vicious cycle. You go through it and you have to take the necessary steps to do a procedure to get him to the next step. But getting him to that next step is going to set him back. It's going to help, but it's going to set him back. So we've been just going through that. So we're in the process now of trying to get him strong enough to have that surgery. Because when he has this surgery, it's going to be another long surgery. And he's already had the challenge of lung collapse and just everything. So
I just feel like I still walk around on eggshells. And I still haven't, the adrenaline hasn't stopped. And I guess eventually, I know I think about it a lot now. I'm like, oh my goodness, it's been almost 2 years and I'm just so tired. But I can't stop, because if I stop, then he may stop. And I need him to keep fighting. So I have to keep fighting, but I'm really tired. like just emotionally, I haven't had a chance to have that woosah moment. And I think that it's wearing or has worn on my body. Some days I feel like I'm really depressed about this whole situation. But, you know, what can I do? But keep going. When I first met Dr. Beard, I didn't realize she was pregnant. But after a few months of getting to know her, I asked her about it. And we had some conversation about her getting ready to have a second child in the next couple of months. And that worried me because I knew she would go on maternity leave and I didn't want to lose her.
It can be kind of anonymous for patients, you know, coming when you have a system where there needs to be 24/7 coverage. So honestly, his care took a lot out of me, I have to say, because it was something that was always there. Like, what's going to happen now? What are we going to have to deal with? And maybe that's also the shared experience, too. It's just obviously his mom's dedicated to him, and I wouldn't necessarily compare us, but constantly, you know, watching out for him, trying to preempt any problems. He was admitted to the hospital for a long time and many, many times. It's a lot of responsibility. But I think we're getting, you know, we're on the other side, which is why it's even possible, really, to have these conversations. You know, I mean, for me, at least we're on the other side. For him, it doesn't sound like we really are, or at least we're on a different journey, so.
Yes, Walter was shot. Walter survived. And 2 years later, we're trying to still get to normalcy. So I guess when they're telling that story, I guess there's never any follow-up. And because we have so many gunshot victims, especially just right here in Philadelphia, I guess it's almost hard to follow up on each and every victim. But I just feel like as far as the media goes, there needs to be something said. Even with the documentaries that I see now, it just discusses people that were shot and, yeah, talking about gun control and controlling violence and how do we do all of those things, because they have so many advocacy programs, gunshot victims advocacy programs, where gunshot victims can go and talk about their experience. However, when you have patients that are still struggling with verbalizing what they've gone through, how do you help them? Because even though Walter is alive, I feel like I've lost my son. So I'm like, I know you're in there somewhere, just being able to pull it out of him. Like, that is the struggle that we're having now. What do you think about that, Dr. Beard?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say things in your life change you, you know, and I don't know that Walter's going to be the exact same person that he was before, you know, and then maybe once his physical state is closer to how he was before, more independent, then working on his emotional state as well, you know, because I think it's hard to, like, it's impossible to quantify the emotional trauma that he's been through. And I just think, like, I think we have to be patient and wait for him to be ready to talk to us and offer support for him when he is, you know.
So I guess that's one of the challenges that I'm facing with myself, is not pushing him too much. I'm trying to find a balance where I don't want to be a crutch and he never gets to where he needs to be. But I also am trying to, you know, work on my compassion, because, you know, as a parent, you want to push your child to be all that they can be. So I'm just trying to work with that. Walt, do you think mom's too hard on you sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say about that? What can you say to me to help me understand what you're going through and what you need from me? What'd you say?
So I don't know.
You don't know? So that is pretty much what I get. But you are making great progress, Walt, and I don't want you to think that I don't see that and that I'm not acknowledging that and celebrating that with you, because you definitely have come a long way. I just don't want you to stop. And I'm so proud that you fought so hard to get to the point you are now. But I need you to keep going. You can't stop. You got to keep pushing if you want to get back to maybe not how you were before, because I pray to God that he makes you better than you've ever been. But we have to keep moving forward. And you can't stop. I know you get tired. I realize that because I get tired too. But I just need you to keep pushing. And the basic things that need to happen, I need you to work harder at doing those things. So you can see for yourself. So how do you feel about your progress so far, your recovery? Do you see differences? How do you feel about your progress?
Good.
What makes you feel good?
I'm making progress.
What progress do you feel like you've accomplished?
I don't know.
You can't think of anything? What about just being able to go up and down the steps? Remember when you first started, you couldn't even walk up and down the steps.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can go to the door, you can go to the gate and pick up our food deliveries and all kinds of stuff. So that's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Those are accomplishments that you can be proud of. And then from there, you set goals to take and push yourself another step forward. So what is something that you want to accomplish now that you're at this point? What's something that you could do to move yourself to another level? Okay, so we're not going to get a lot of conversation from Walt, but one thing I do know about Walter is he may not always have an answer now, but I believe he does listen. At least that's what he told my sister. I may not do everything you guys tell me at that moment, but I'm listening and I'm processing. So hopefully he's processing. I need people to realize that it's great when a victim pulls through from a gunshot wound, but it's not as simple as this victim was shot and lived. Because now, yeah, some people, they are gunshot victims, and maybe next week they're up and moving around and life goes on and it doesn't affect your life. But that's not always the case. And when it causes so much bodily harm that you're almost having to start your life over. I don't know if that's the right terminology, but just being at a level where you're totally dependent on someone else to trying to get back to being independent. And I think that that might be harder or worse than being shot, trying to recover and get your life back. So it's not just as simple as a victim being shot
and surviving. It's way more than that. It's way more than that for everyone involved, from medical staff to the victim and family. You know, it's a total journey, a total struggle. So when you're out there and you're committing these violent crimes, it's almost like, do you want your family going through that? You know, maybe you shoot someone, you take a life. Maybe you shoot them, you don't take a life. But either way, you're affecting not just that person, you're affecting a community. Because I know, Dr. Beard, you have to be, I don't want to say consumed, but I know that seeing this constant flow of patients coming in through the emergency room as gunshot victims, it has to be wearing on you as a person. So how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is wearing on you as a person, as somebody who's really dedicates their life to trying to help people who've been injured by gun violence. You know, they've done studies that have shown that a lot of trauma surgeons have PTSD. Basically, what we do is probably the closest that it comes to being kind of in an active combat zone. And at Temple, you know, we take care of people who've been shot at very high volume, sometimes more than one or two patients at a time can come in. I think we all are sort of part of this story, and all of us sort of experience the trauma. So
I got a text message in the middle of the night from my job, and there was an active shooter situation at Jefferson. And I got that text at like 12:30 in the morning, and I couldn't even go back to sleep that night, because every time I hear about a gun victim or some type of shooting, whether it's on the streets of Philadelphia or just anywhere in our country, it just wears on me. Because I think before, I thought about the fact that there was so much gun violence, but I guess just like with the news, I never really thought about the after effects. I feel like I was almost like the media. Okay, there was a gunshot victim and they lived. Like, whew, they lived. But what does that mean? You know what I mean? What does it mean to live? Do they live like they lived before? Or are they living? Are they vegetables? Are they in a wheelchair? It's just very devastating that the people, that the family, the community is, it's almost like it's deteriorating one by one from all of these, all of these tragedies that are going on in our world. It's like, I don't even know. We talk about gun violence, what we can do. We talk about the effects of poverty and why people do the things that they do. I don't even know where you start to even touch on it. It's like, I don't know if, just like me, I didn't think about everything that happened after that victim was shot. The victim was shot, he lived. Oh, yay, you know? But now, being a part of all of that, that has gone on, and I guess it's being more informed, it's really heartbreaking. Not just for my son, but for all involved.
I totally agree. I think you know, the way that we kind of tell these short stories about gun violence in the media, or the way violence is sort of normalized and outside of media, those things are all sort of part of the way that the public and individuals can just sort of somehow look past gun violence. I feel like so much of part of my job is to tell what it's like to be on the front lines of this too, right? Like, rather than just kind of quietly coming to work and dealing with it, like, we need to be outraged by it too, you know, and we need to not normalize it. Although on the day-to-day, we kind of have to. And it's hard. I mean, it's emotionally challenging to not normalize it, right?
I'm looking back over this time and when my son Walter was shot, and I'm just looking at the news and I'm seeing that there's so much gun violence in our city, and there are a great number of deaths, but there are a greater number of people that have been shot and are recovering. I guess when I look back at the moment that this happened, because you see on TV, you see on in the movies, you see on the news, and they talk about people that have been shot. And then you see a lot of times people are shot and they recover instantly. It's like they may have been shot this week and maybe 2 weeks later, you know, they are better. So I guess that is kind of like, it puts a picture in your mind. And when reality sets in, it tells a whole nother story.
I don't enjoy watching the local news, and I don't want to. And like you said, whenever I hear these horrible stories about gunshot victims, or like, it takes me back to that night. I think about the families. I think about, oh no, like, whoever this just happened to, they're about to go through what we went through that night. And that's not, I don't wish that on anybody. And at some point, I was just afraid for Walter even to go out. I'm like, oh, I don't want him to go out. Shorty, don't, you know, I probably didn't say it, but I didn't even want him to go out, even when he was home. Like, I was so afraid for him. You know, just, I don't know. Like, it's just afraid. It's afraid. Like, if I'm around too many people, it makes me nervous. Like, it's just, I didn't necessarily feel that way before. You know?
It definitely can paralyze you. I know when I just even hear sirens going past, it's almost like your body just gets stiff. I don't go out a lot. I don't even want to. Some days I think I probably need to get out the house. I work from home. I'm always home. But I don't know. I might go to the store, run some quick errands. Or if we have, you know, something social between our friends. But outside of that, I'm good with being at home. I don't want to be out and about like that, because you see, you can be anywhere and just get shot for no reason. And then COVID on top of that, but you know. That didn't help. Walter has come a long way. And so have we as a family, just in our healing process and trying to be there for him.
We went to the basketball court. He was doing some shots and he was walking. I said, well, you actually have to run after the ball, you know, when you throw it and you need to catch it. So he did a little jog. I was excited about that. He's definitely getting better.
And that's just a great milestone.
I just want to fix it for Walter. I just want to know what's going on. And like the other day when I talked to him, I think he said that he was bored. And I said, well, whatever you want to do. I said, write down, you know, some things you want to do and let's just try to do it.
I just really hope that Walter decides to kind of open up and be a part, because, I mean, it's his story. Of course, I'm living in that story, but I would just really like him to just have a conversation and kind of talk about it and maybe be able to encourage someone else that may have gone through a similar situation. You know, you hear about people getting shot and you don't hear about it again. They survive. And then you hear about people that were shot 7, 8, 9 times and 2 weeks later, they're walking around, the bullet went in, the bullet went out, and, you know, all of those different things. It's just mind-boggling. One gunshot to the stomach can change your life. I mean, I don't want to say for years, because I'm sure that this is a life-changing experience for him and he'll take it with him throughout life. I don't think he'll let it get him down per se. He's a little depressed and he's still trying to find his way. But I just keep saying, I think that, you know, God doesn't give us more than what we can handle. And sometimes what breaks us down lifts us up and puts us where we need to be in life. So that's my thought on that for Walter. And I just keep praying that, you know, God didn't bring him this far to leave him. And he's lost some years. He's lost some time. He's lost some experience. The experience of really being a father and being able to interact. Walter loves children. So it kind of like breaks my heart that, you know, he can't do all of the things that he would like to do with his children. And he doesn't say much, but he did say that. So that spoke volumes to me. So I think that is one of the things that weighs on him heavily.
I feel like I have come a long way from where I started, and I wanted to get better so I can play with my sons and pick them up and teach them sports.
As you might be able to tell, we recorded the conversations for this podcast over Zoom. Walter was there for some of them, but he didn't say much, even when I asked him pointed questions. We ended up giving him those questions to answer on his own time, however he wanted to do it, if he even wanted to do it at all. It ended up happening at our house with Tanya, his girlfriend. They had sports on in the background while they recorded a voice memo together on my phone. I was so proud of Walter and amazed that he answered those questions so clearly and thoughtfully.
What have you accomplished?
I can eat, cook, watch by myself, take out the trash, talk, go on walks, and hang out with my friends and family.
I feel like I'm constantly navigating between being supportive and encouraging Walter and pushing him to keep going. I don't know whether it's fear or if it's conditioning from being in the bed for so long, but he doesn't seem to have the confidence or motivation to do all the things he did before.
I don't think it's fair. I just think that I just need to start getting back to my old self.
So what are some of the things you're going to do to get back to your old self?
I don't know.
No, you got to know. What's the things that you love to do that make you want to get up every day and go?
Probably when I start working again.
Okay, when you start working again, that's good. What do you want to do when you go back to work?
I don't know. Just make some money. So I can help out Tanya and Zubair.
And
Gabe and Alyssa.
Okay. What do you want to do for his work? Do you want to be in the kitchen? You want to cook? What do you want to do for it?
I want to cook.
Are you having any feelings about your progress?
Yes, I'm happy. I'm becoming healthy and stronger every day.
It's just so much, and I just think that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So I think we'll all be stronger after this. And I just wish that I could, help someone else to make it. That's it. That's all I got. After dealing with everything that comes along with being shot and surviving and everything Walter and I and our family have gone through, seeing the statistics on murder and violence, it breaks my heart. During 2021, there were 562 homicides in Philadelphia, and the vast majority were fatal shootings. Nearly 500 people were shot and killed. More than 1,800 others were shot and survived. I pray for those families, for their loss, and those who are surviving, like Walter and me. Stronger Every Day, Healing After Gun Violence, is a collaboration between the Philadelphia Center for Gun Violence Reporting and Covenda Media, with additional support from the Stoneley Foundation. Through PCGVR's Credible Messenger Journalism Project, the Credible Messenger Initiative pairs community reporters affected by gun violence, like me, with journalists and more traditional news organizations who guide story production and distribution, and equitably compensates us for our participation in the project. This podcast was produced by me, Tashawn Strother, along with Emily Previty and Stephanie Marutis of Covenda Media, and mixed by Brad Linder. Special thanks to my family, Dr. Jessica Beard and Jim McMillan. Thanks to everyone who listened to Walter's story. I hope you can take away something that either helps you to help someone else or just to let you know that you are not alone. It's a hard situation when you're dealing with death and violence. So thank you, and be safe.